You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 14th of March 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London. This is The Globalist. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, Russia has reportedly asked China for help in the conflict with Ukraine. This comes as peace talks continue and the war grows ever closer to NATO's border.
Poland has taken, in just a very short period of time, in excess of 1.5 million refugees in from Ukraine. And that has put an extraordinary burden on Poland and the people of Poland.
We'll examine the refugee situation in Poland as the country's infrastructure and the goodwill of volunteers begins to buckle under the pressure. Then,
there's one person who would have a very quick and easy answer to that, and that is Vladimir Putin. He can very quickly tell you what the difference is between Russian and Ukrainian, and probably his answer is, well, actually, Ukrainian doesn't exist.
Writer Viv Groskop examines Russian and Ukrainian identity, plus the current threat of cyber attacks and the impact of the invasion on the art world. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz will visit Turkey's President Recep Erdogan in Ankara today to discuss Russia's invasion of Ukraine, amongst other issues. Britain's Defence Ministry has said that the Russian Navy has established a distant blockade of Ukraine's Black Sea coast, effectively isolating Ukraine from international maritime trade. And the United States has condemned an Iranian attack on Iraq's northern city of Erbil, stating that it backs Baghdad and its other allies in the region in the face of threats from Tehran. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Over the weekend, Russian airstrikes hit a large military base near the western city of Lviv, close to the Polish border. An American journalist has been killed in the conflict, and a spate of Russian missile attacks hit critical infrastructure as well as urban areas. Well, Andriy Dzhela, Ukrainian technology journalist, currently in Kamenetsky in western Ukraine, and Aglaya Smeklov, who is a lecturer on international politics of Russia at UCL and the author of Russia's security policy under Putin, both join me on the line now. Thank you very much for coming on. Andriy, if we could start with you, tell us about this attack near the border with Poland, please.
Hi, good morning. Thanks a lot for having me. Pleasure to be here. And so the attack was targeted at the International Security and Peacekeeping Center near the city of Yavoriv. And that is, if you look at the map, it's between the city of Lviv and Ukraine's border with Poland. So it's literally next to the border. It's about 20 kilometers or even less than that. So, and the attack was apparently massive. It was said that about 30 rockets had been fired towards this training facility, and 8 of them had hit it at the end. So what the center is all about, so it was the place where a lot of joint drills and trainings between Ukrainian armed forces and NATO countries have been held over the years. So in many ways, I would say that it is a symbolic target, if you will. Mm. And initially, there were only reports of several people who were killed, but by now we know that at least 35 people had been killed and many more than 100 people were injured in this attack.
And is it correct to say that many of those people would have been foreign fighters?
It is not yet confirmed. It is yet to be confirmed how many like the nationalities of these people. It could be that some of the foreign volunteers were stationed there, but I have not seen official reports from the Ukrainian side on that.
Glaya, if we could come to you now. There are reports that Russia's requested military help from China. Do we have much detail on that?
Thank you for having me on. So, we don't have additional information. This did come out of a report released from the US, At this stage, the Chinese are denying it and are saying that no such assistance is going to be provided. I think what's important is that you can see this in the context of the flurry of negotiations and also pressure points. The importance is that you will have a senior level meeting today between US and Chinese counterparts in Rome. And in part, I think this is perhaps a pressure tactic that is being imposed by the Americans on the Chinese to ensure that they are not going to supply the Russians, whether it's true or not, but also to move the Chinese away from this attempt to act as a go-between and pick more the pro-West, pro-US side than the Russian side.
Mm. Andriy, on the ground, have you seen Russian weaponry and tactics changing? I mean, there are reports of now phosphorus bombs.
Yes, I have seen those reports as well, and but I think they were only deployed in one city. As of tactics, so I think the movement of the troops seems to have slowed down, which probably was predictable as the time goes by. So right now, what I can see here in the west of the country, which has not seen a lot of heavy fighting on the ground per se, we are now having much more air raid alerts, and there are more attacks, like long-range air attacks on different targets in this region, including the Yavoriv military range, but also several airports and military airfields, including ones in Vinnytsia, here in the Khmelnytsky region, as well as in Ivano-Frankivsk, and also elsewhere in cities like Dnipro. So I think this is one part, and the other part would be that there are now a few very crucial cities that seem to be particularly important for the Russian troops to encircle and try to take. Of course, the main one would be Kyiv, which is the capital of Ukraine, and it definitely has been the ultimate goal since the beginning of the invasion. However, there are also other cities like Sumy, like Chernihiv, and of course Mariupol, which is facing a humanitarian catastrophe right now and has been besieged for about 2 weeks, and people cannot actually leave the city because the Russian troops are not keeping the ceasefires that they agree on with the Ukrainian authorities.
Mm. Aglaya, we've seen that some senior FSB officials have been arrested. Is there a possibility that the inner circle is turning against Putin? There was also unconfirmed reports of shooting heard near the Kremlin.
So at this stage, we have not seen any of the inner circle actually going against Putin. None of the reports have alluded to that. What we are perhaps seeing is the regime beginning to turn against its own and those who are seen to have been responsible for some of the failures of the operation in Ukraine. So, for example, there have been reports of the FSB deputies being put under house arrest, particularly those who were responsible for gathering the intelligence on the ground in Ukraine prior to Russia's war. That particular branch was responsible for surveying the public opinion on the subject, and their conclusions from the reports that we have seen essentially suggested that the Ukrainian public was disenchanted with its government, that they were generally unhappy with the situation in the country. And it suggested that the FSB therefore made the assumptions and fed into the general narrative that Russia's war in Ukraine would be quick and swift. And what we are seeing is the regime going against those particular branches that have fed that information.
Mm. Andriy, I wonder how Vladimir Zelensky's been reacting to the latest developments.
The president has been, I would say the communication has been very well established so far between the president and the country, let's say the citizens. Zelensky posts statements, mostly video statements, very often. So he tries to keep in touch, and I think it has been working, both from himself, but also from the rest of the authorities. We are seeing a lot of direct communication, which is, I think, what the country and the people need at this point.
Yeah, and Aglaya, a second mayor has been abducted, we hear, and there was chilling footage of a Russian-backed replacement giving a statement. Is this Russia's aim to fill key government posts with Kremlin-loyal officials?
Yeah, so the developments over the weekend and prior to that have demonstrated perhaps a little bit more insight into what the Russians are hoping to do. It seems to suggest that the Russians would be less interested in keeping direct control over the cities and the towns that they are trying to take over, and that essentially you would have a replication of what they've done in Luhansk and Donetsk, which is very much to get the locals to be placed in the positions of authority, essentially supporting the Russian regime. Now, this is essentially a replication of what the Russians have done. At the same time, you have had massive reports of sort of local sentiments against that, criticisms coming at all fronts. And it shows, I would suggest, that the actual difficulties of installing that strategy on the ground in Ukraine. Essentially, the local Ukrainian population are against any installment of Russian puppets from Moscow and will be pushing against it, which again shows in practice how unviable the Russian strategy in Ukraine actually is.
And finally, to you, Andriy, what is the mood where you are now? Are people still optimistic that this can be won?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure that it is true over here where I'm right now in the west in Khmelnytsky, but I'm also in touch with quite a few people in hotter spots of the country right now. And I think the vast majority of people are still optimistic that the invasion can be repelled, the war can be won, and that it will happen sooner than later.
Andriy Degella in Ukraine and Aglaya Snetkov here. Thank you both very much indeed. Well, it's just gone 7:13 here in London. That's 8:13 in Warsaw, which is where we're off to next. The mayor of the Polish capital, Warsaw, is appealing for international help as the city becomes overwhelmed by refugees, with more than a tenth of all those fleeing the war in Ukraine arriving in the capital. Well, Mateusz Mazini is a writer at large at Gazeta Wyborcza and a lecturer in journalism at Collegium Civitas in Warsaw and joins me now. Mateusz, lovely to have you on the show. Poland has accepted something like 1.7 million refugees from Ukraine. That's according to the latest figures. How many of those are heading to the capital?
Very good morning to you, Georgina. It's actually quite hard to answer that question specifically because we don't really monitor here in the country where people go after they cross the border. So we have various figures. The officials say it's around 170,000 people already here in Warsaw, but some NGOs estimate that this number could be actually even twice as large. They usually arrive either by train, so most of the train stations here in Warsaw are overwhelmed, to say the least, with the constant inflow of people from the east, but a lot of them just take private cars or buses. They join the families if they were already residing here in Poland. They just take on the offers of various volunteers that drive on their own account to the border and offer safe passage into the country. So it's really hard to say how many people are here. The one thing that we know for certain is that the vast majority of those would be single mothers with little children.
And in terms of help from strangers, is there a vetting process? Is there any evidence of trafficking? How safe are those people?
Well, in the grand scheme of things, I think they're safe, but we haven't established any vetting process on a nationwide scale, which is part of the reason why, according to some of the people working on the ground with the refugees, we're either already in the midst of a humanitarian crisis or at the brink of it, because the first respondents were very quick. The wave of optimism and hospitality on behalf of the Polish people, just as described by the foreign media, was unprecedented, but this could only be sustained for week, two, three, maybe a month. We're entering the 20th day of that war, and volunteers can only do as much. NGOs are deprived of systemic help. They're running on fumes in terms of the resources, especially including human resources and material ones. And volunteers, even though there were many of them in the first weeks, and there are still reports of lots and lots of people driving eastwards to offer passage into the country, they're not being vetted, and most of all, they're not really professional. So we have a wave of volunteers running kitchens, collecting supplies, running online donation collections, and all sorts of helps. But at a certain point in time, there's a clash between what's needed and what's possible to be offered by those people, because at the end of the day, they all have careers, they all have daily jobs, they all have families to attend to. And trying to accept, trying to accommodate 1.7, already over 1.7 million people on the basis of sheer support of the society, it's just not a sustainable project.
And what role does the state play in this then?
So depending who you ask, obviously, if you ask the government officials, they will tell you, yes, the situation is very difficult. But Poland, because of its fantastic hospitality, because of that first wave of support, is doing very well. But we need support from the European Union. But then if you ask people, as I said before, working on the ground, the situation is very bad or even drastic, because the government has resorted to policies of oversight and delegation. There were obviously legal solutions put in place to help Ukrainians in Poland. Just last weekend, a new Help the Ukrainians bill was passed through the parliament. So the Ukrainian refugees, not only were they obviously let into the country without any requirements through the border right after the invasion started, they're now being given access to healthcare, to social security, they can legally work and register. But there are more systemic issues here that cannot be solved by means of one single legislation. Just to give you an example, we're estimated to accept over a million school kids over the course of this conflict. Over a million school kids would translate into 1,800 schools. And according to the to the Center of Educational Support, an NGO that monitors quality of education in the Polish public system, there are only 100 intercultural professionally trained educators here, which shows you the disparity and the challenge that Poland is going to have to face.
Mm. Are you seeing a difference as the war rolls on in the type of refugees coming to Poland? I mean, the first wave were probably more affluent. They could afford to move countries, they could rent apartments and so on. Is that changing? And what happens when the truly desperate arrive?
This is what most of the people working on the ground fear in Poland, that the pardon my wording, but the easy part has already materialized. It's a natural process in fleeing conflict. Those who are more financially capable, those who have more resources, those who have skills that are useful in the foreign economy, or most of all know the language, they are already here. But according to United Nations, the total toll of refugees fleeing Ukraine as a result of this conflict could reach even 10 million, out of which 4 to 5 will probably stay in Poland, also because of the similarities in language. It's just easier for them to be here rather than Romania to Ukraine. We're not seeing that difference yet, but we know it will materialize. We know that the second wave will be completely different and more challenging.
Matej, we're aware that there was a racist response at the border, with many people of Asian or African heritage finding it difficult to enter Poland. As more and more refugees come and space runs out, is it likely that refugee camps will be set up? And if so, are those likely to be segregated? I mean, this looks like it has the basis for being something really very chilling.
I think at this point in time, given the situation that we're facing, some sort of a refugee camp-like solution is unavoidable for a simple reason that, you know, being blunt, we don't have anywhere to place those people in. Warsaw has run out of flats. The city of Przemysl, which is one of the biggest cities in eastern Poland, has roughly 200,000 people, has run out of flats for rent in the fifth day since the invasion started. Poland has a largely non-existent sector of social housing, and the total real estate market is one of the smallest in Europe. We have EU's second to worst ratio of property per 1,000 inhabitants. It's only 393 flats per 1,000 people. Only Slovakia has a lower ratio. So if those people, if Ukrainian refugees decide to stay here for longer, it's obviously unimaginable that they will be staying under volunteers' roofs for half a year or two. Obviously, nobody wants to be a refugee that long. They would want to get back on their feet, find jobs, rent apartments. But we just simply don't have those places to offer if we wanted to. So I think some sort of, I'm reluctant to use the word segregation because it sounds chilling and very powerful, but some sort of refugee camp-like solutions would probably have to be implemented.
Mateusz, thank you very much indeed. Mateusz Mazzini there speaking to us from Warsaw. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll discuss how well the West is prepared for Russian cyber attacks. And the art newspaper's Ben Lute will be here to break down how the war in Ukraine is impacting the global art market. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, with the war in Ukraine continuing to rage, the question of what it means for the future of global diplomacy was on the minds of officials from nearly 100 countries who gathered in the southern Turkish city of Antalya for an annual diplomacy forum that wrapped up on Sunday afternoon. Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak was there for us and spoke to Jeffrey Feltman, a former US diplomat and United Nations Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Feltman began by talking about why the diplomacy forum in Antalya, only in its second year, was particularly timely at this point.
What's, I think, interesting about it for all of us is, first of all, it's happening, and it's happening in person. It's been 2 years, for me at least, since I've been in any kind of gathering like this, where you can actually pull people aside and have quick conversations, get a lot done, and not have to schedule Zoom meetings, not have to worry about making sure you've turned off your mute button. You know, that this is a way to compare notes with people on international peace and security developments, on how diplomacy works. What's also, of course, the discussions are supposed to be about, and the formal discussions are supposed to be about, how you basically retool diplomacy for the challenges of the 21st century, the challenges that we face now, 22 years into the 21st century. But like other events that are held around the world, say like the General Assembly at the United Nations every year, there's also an informal theme. It's what everyone's talking about in the corridors, what everyone's talking about in the bilateral meetings, what everyone's talking about in the pull-asides over meals when you have coffee with people, and that's Ukraine. I don't think it would have been possible for as many leaders, representatives of foundations, academia, think tanks, government ministries, people like me who have worked in mediation, it would have been possible to have as many conversations about what is a number one piece of security challenge if there weren't something physically in person. You know, imagine trying to have a Zoom meeting with all the people that one can see in the course of 2.5 days here. So I appreciate the fact that the Turks were able to pull this off in person at a time when we face a real crisis with the war in Ukraine.
And how exactly are those conversations going from the ones you've been a part of or what you get a sense of in the room? What is being talked about in terms of how your job, mediation, has to change as a result of what's happening in Ukraine?
sort of the fundamental assumptions about the world in which we lived in, the geostrategic environment in which we're all operating, are shaken by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, by the Russian war in Ukraine. You know, the United Nations Charter, written in the aftermath of World War II, was designed, to quote the charter, to prevent seceding generations from the scourge of war. But what it was about war between states. You know, it was written in response to World War I and World War II, which were wars between states. And over the past, you know, 20, 30 years, most conflicts arise from within states, from conflicts inside states. You look at Syria or Yemen or Ethiopia. Those were conflicts that arose because of grievances inside states. They had regional international implications. There was interference from outside actors. But the basic issues were inside states. And that, in some ways, was a challenge for, say, the United Nations, because the Charter is basically silent on what happens if there's a conflict inside a state. So the various mechanisms were developed, various different groups were set up to try to work on how you would open the door for mediation in the case of domestic disputes to try to prevent or resolve conflict. But now we're back in a conflict that we thought was behind us. You have a war that the UN Charter was supposed to have outlawed, and again, that we haven't really seen in the past 20, 30 years, the type of war between states. So what does that mean for all of us? If these fundamental assumptions that we no longer really had invasions for territory, wars between states, if these assumptions are no longer valid, how do we recreate a system that does guarantee the territorial integrity, the independence of states?
There was, of course, this meeting between Lavrov and Kuleba, the Ukrainian Russian foreign ministers. What is your sense of how Turkey has placed itself as a mediator of conflicts? Is it something unique about Ukraine, Russia, where they have a role, or do you also get the sense that Turkey has a bigger role to play, that the kind of the traditional sort of countries that we look at for mediation is maybe changing?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, on Turkey specifically, of course, Turkey has direct interest, you know, the Black Sea, etc. Turkey's a Black Sea country. There's the Bosphorus and the transit from Black Sea onward. So there's a direct Turkish interest, geostrategic interest in what's happening on the other shores of the Black Sea. But Turkey also has positive relations with both Kyiv and Moscow, so that Turkey could be seen as being even though Turkey's a member of NATO, Turkey could probably be seen as, say, a more impartial actor than, say, the United States would be in this case. So I applaud the Turks for having tried to use the relationships that they've had with Kyiv and Moscow to try to bring the two sides together. I'm sorry that the meeting did not seem to produce very much tangible in terms of trying to create the conditions for humanitarian corridors to operate effectively, let alone the idea of moving toward a ceasefire and ending the killing of innocent civilians. But I also think that the question of impartiality for a mediator is one that needs to be considered in light of what's the conflict we're talking about. But there are other times, look at what's happened inside Myanmar, for example, with the military coup, and before that with the 2017 expulsion and killings of the Rohingya. I'm not sure, say, an impartial mediator would have had much influence on the generals. And that's the kind of case where you would hope that a country like China, interested in stability of its neighborhood, would be able to try to play a role, because China would have influence over the generals because they have leverage on the generals. So there's sometimes in mediation when impartiality is the right approach. There are other times when you need to have a country that has the ability to really exercise leverage on those that need to enter into a mediation process.
That was the US diplomat Jeffrey Feltman in conversation with Monocle's Chris Chermak in Antalya. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz will visit Turkey's President Recep Erdogan in Ankara today to discuss Russia's invasion of Ukraine, amongst other issues. Mr. Scholz is expected to try and persuade Mr. Erdogan that Turkey's friendship with Vladimir Putin has run its course. Britain's defense ministry said that the Russian Navy has established a distant blockade of Ukraine's Black Sea coast, effectively isolating Ukraine from international maritime trade. It also said that Russia may again attempt an amphibious landing in the Sea of Azov in the coming weeks. And the United States has condemned an Iranian attack on Iraq's northern city of Erbil, stating that it backs Baghdad and its other allies in the region in the face of threats from Tehran. Iran's Revolutionary Guards claimed credit for the late-night strike in which 12 ballistic missiles were fired against an alleged Israeli strategic centre of conspiracy in the Kurdish city. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. The Kremlin's war on Ukraine is being fought on land, sea and in the air, and now in the added dimension of cyberspace. Since Russia invaded Ukraine on the 24th of February, there's been an 800% increase of suspected cyber attacks from Russia. Well, joining me here in the studio is Antonio Weiss, senior partner at the PSC and the author of The Practical Guide to Digital Transformation. Antonio, thanks very much for coming in. Can you outline the scope and the type of cyber attacks Russia's been launching?
Yes, well, cyber crime and cyber attacks tend to take a number of dimensions. The first is sort of theft and damage of information, and that's something that we know has been happening historically in Ukraine. So the NotPetya attacks in 2017 shows that there's a long history here. But actually, it's the two others which we see that have particularly ramped up. So one is around disinformation or misinformation, and that's not often thought of as being as cyber crime, but very much is, and we can see that through various propaganda means which are going through. And then finally, it's threats to actual infrastructure. And in many ways, that's the most damaging area. So we're aware through various reports of potential attacks on the national rail line, an attempt at a so-called distributed denial of service, effectively knocking down information, which was fended off actually by the Ukrainian forces and also with some US support. But it's those infrastructure attacks which are particularly concerning because they effectively knock out vital parts of the and operations of the country.
In this current crisis, is this limited to targets within Ukraine?
Not necessarily. So cybercrime tends to be what we call sort of very leaky. And because of the interconnected nature of so much software and indeed hardware, it can actually spread. So whilst it would appear at the moment that much of the focus is on Ukraine, that it can nonetheless have impacts elsewhere. So again, that 2017 attack, NotPetya, which started very much as a focus on highly used Ukrainian accounting tax software, actually spread throughout the world and indeed hit many major US firms as well. So whilst it could be start initially localized, it can easily spread.
I mean, given Russia's proven expertise and track record in this area, I wonder why we haven't seen a bigger cyber attack on Ukraine.
It's interesting. I think one of the arguments is that the so-called kinetic warfare is actually been the main domain and clearly is having a major impact, and perhaps they're choosing to focus their efforts mainly there. Nonetheless, we are aware through various national intelligence reports that there nonetheless is a lot of cyber warfare going on, and this has a long-standing history. So back in 2015, they knocked off the power grids in Kyiv, and you could argue that a lot of that was preparing the groundwork, and there may be more to come.
Mm-hmm. How much of a threat, then, do you think Russia represents to the rest of the world? How much of a cyber threat?
Russia clearly has significant capabilities in this area, although it's by no means alone. So the NHS WannaCry attacks, which knocked out much of the many hospital operating systems in the UK in 2017, whilst nobody's completely certain, they believe that those were actors mainly from North Korea. So it can come from all nations and countries. It is known, however, that there are what you might call sort of ransomware as a service setups in Russia, where effectively, organized criminals can effectively outsource cyber attacks to people setting those up and running those from Russia. So it is certainly one of the major actors.
Is there an agreed official international response to acts of cyber warfare?
This is one of the interesting areas. So not really, and that's particularly why it can be, in times of outside of full conflict, quite a popular way of destabilizing a country, because it's perceived to be slightly below the radar or below the threshold of a full military attack. So it doesn't necessarily generate the same concerted response. So a NATO country probably wouldn't, and historically hasn't, seen a cyber attack as being akin to a military attack, even if there are sort of deaths and severe damage which result. And I think that's something which, as cyber crime and threats and attacks increase, we'll be increasingly looking at on an international dimension. Mm.
Now, we've seen Ukrainians fighting back. I mean, they're also very advanced in that area. Indeed, citizens from all over the world countering this disinformation. But I wonder if there's a way that we can individually keep ourselves safe.
There are various means. I mean, obviously, if national critical infrastructure were to go out, there's very little we can do about that. So a lot of it is about hoping that policymakers and government officials maintain cybersecurity high up on the agenda. But as individuals, I think it's Jen Eastley, who's the director of CISA, which is the sort of the US GCHQ equivalent, you know, has a wonderful line, which is effectively you're 99% more safe from a hack if you have multi-factor authentication. So by that means, you know, not just having a password, but having a strong password and having it linked to a phone account or other forms of authentication. And that is the safest way to protect yourself from, on a personal level, from attacks, and also from many government infrastructure bits will be their weakest entry point will be that of a human's credentials.
Just to end, though, I don't want to sound alarmist about this, but should we be writing down all our contacts physically? Should we be taking out large amounts of cash? What happens then if the phone networks go down, if the banking networks go down, if we can't contact anybody? How do we deal with that? How can we be best prepared?
So every single key infrastructure and organisation needs to have a resilience and disaster recovery plan, which literally answers the question, what happens if we can't access any of our data? We've seen that in the airline industry. We've seen hospitals respond in that way. And that is the only way to get through this. So what happens if, you know, you turn on the computer and it doesn't work? Everyone needs to have a safe and secure response for that in the short term.
And that would be what?
Well, having workflows from literally writing down and storing information in ledgers, communicating those through other means which don't use computer networks or telephone networks, then go back to being very important, and having a quick recovery plan that then can try and get you back on track. Some of that in a more sophisticated way might involve sort of separating out data into different buckets, so that if one area gets compromised, then another doesn't. But in the short term, it's about keeping the lights on.
And don't lose your landline. Thank you very much to Antonio Weiss. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. In Moscow, that's 8:38 in Zurich, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me from our Zurich studio is Alexandra Turtzu, who's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and contributing editor at the New York Sun. Alexandra, thanks very much for coming into our Duferstrasse 90 studio. Let's start by talking about the Pope, because he has been making various statements this Sunday.
Yes, good morning, and it's a pleasure to be with you. The Pope has indeed started to be a bit more vocal about the conflict in Ukraine, and this is something for which he had been previously somewhat criticized for not really having spoken out. And there's a piece actually in the Spectator World. Michael Warren Davis takes on exactly this topic. And as Davis points out, the Russian invasion really upsets two of the Pope's long-term major goals, the first being a diplomatic thaw between the East and the West, which is at least part of the reason for his friendly, some would argue, too friendly relationships with both Russia and China over the years. And also, and secondly, his aim of a reconciliation between the Catholic and the Orthodox churches, which have, of course, been at odds for centuries. And so not wanting to detract from either of those objectives, that the Pope for a while has been content with, at least so far, not doing too much and not really speaking out and calling Russia out by name. And now yesterday that started to shift a little bit. Of course, in his Sunday sermon, he called for an end to the unacceptable armed aggression. And also, he was a bit active on his Twitter account, posting a similar message calling for an end to the war with the hashtags, you know, let's pray together, Ukraine and peace. And I think that the narrative around the Pope also raises and points to interesting dynamics within the church, also the Russian Orthodox Church, where we're starting to see some fissures and potentially splintering. The head of the Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, he of course has close ties with Putin, and so continues to sanction his actions in Ukraine. But at the same time, you've had some 280 clerics from the Russian Orthodox Church speak out against the war. The Guardian over the weekend reported that an Orthodox church in Amsterdam has officially split with Moscow. Somewhat ironically, it's asked to join the Russian church in Constantinople, which is seen as a rival to the Russian Orthodox Church. So there's a good amount of internal jostling and interesting dynamics emerging within the two churches, I suppose, most involved in the conflict, also on the edges.
I'd like to turn now and have a look at foreign fighters in Ukraine, because, of course, we've seen a large influx of those, and indeed some of them may have been targeted in this attack over the weekend near the border with Poland. Tell us more about those people coming in. Are they regarded as mercenaries?
Yes, it's actually very interesting. And the Wall Street Journal has a thorough account of this. And also the NZZ here in Switzerland has a front page piece about Syrian mercenaries, quote unquote, coming to fight with Russia. And interestingly, both Russia and Ukraine have said that they consider these foreign fighters as mercenaries, exactly as you suggested, which means that in the event that they're captured, they wouldn't be treated as prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions, but rather subject to criminal liability. So in other words, they would be tried as war criminals. And you know, we can kind of imagine the consequences that would follow from that. Yesterday, Ukraine's Minister of Foreign Affairs issued a similar warning to the Russian. Again, on his Twitter account, he warned that Ukraine has actually already initiated apparently several cases against Russian foreign fighters in international courts. And he wrote, even if you survive, you will be a war criminal. So this also speaks, I think, interestingly, to the personal risks that many of these foreign fighters who are coming over are taking on. There are some numbers that suggest there are some 20,000 foreigners now enlisted in the Ukrainian International Legion. That the numbers on the Russian side are a little bit more hazy. And there are a lot of interesting dynamics at play in addition to this question about mercenaries. So for instance, with respect to Ukraine's Foreign Legion, and the Wall Street Journal piece speaks to this, there are some who are apparently finding themselves either unsatisfied with the structure or the capabilities, or have come over with other objectives. So emerging alongside, let's say, some of these more formal structures are also a growing number of informal militias that really aren't accountable to any formal institutions inside Ukraine, which is posing its own longer term challenges. And I think here it's also worth noting, and the NZZ and the Wall Street Journal both speak to this too, that some foreign fighters have already deserted, in some cases crossing the border over to Poland and then going on to other parts of Europe, also feeding into this migration crisis that we've been hearing about and speaking about this morning.
Yeah. Alexandra, just finally, very, very quickly, a brief look at what the FT has been saying about Russia asking China for help.
Yes, of course. So the FT is reporting, and as we've also heard this morning, that Russia has allegedly asked China for military equipment to support its invasion in Ukraine. This morning, or today rather, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan is in Rome to meet with his Chinese counterpart. So that makes that meeting all the more important and timely. And I suppose, you know, there are some back and forth whether China will or will not. I think it's unlikely that Beijing, given its posturing in the conflict so far, that it would openly adopt a policy of sending arms to Russia and to Ukraine. But I would suggest that the nature of the PLA is is such that weapons could potentially independently find their way through various back channels, as they have in Syria, for instance, as they have in North Korea, which could, in the event, create a rather curious and also a dangerous proxy war kind of a situation between the United States and China, which we really haven't seen since the Cold War. And the FT has some wonderful coverage, also some great opinion pieces that start to bring these issues and those tensions to light.
Alexandra, thank you very much indeed. That was Alexandra Tietzu in our Zurich studio. And this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Up next on today's show, we hear from celebrated British writer, stand-up comedian and presenter Viv Groskop. In addition to her books, she's created a radio documentary about Russian satire and written about Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and his transition from comedy actor to politician to wartime leader. Well, I began by asking Viv about the differences and similarities between Russia and Ukrainian identity and why they're proving so important in this conflict.
That's such a great, simple question with an answer that we will spend the next 50 years answering. And there's one person who would have a very quick and easy answer to that, and that is Vladimir Putin. He can very quickly tell you what the difference is between Russian and Ukrainian, and probably his answer is, well, actually, Ukrainian doesn't exist. The real answer to that is very complex, because on a simple level, and the way that we see it now on the front page of newspapers is, you know, Ukraine is an independent country. If you're Ukrainian, you live in Ukraine, you live in an independent country, you possibly started out life as a Russian speaker, because until really the last 15, 20 years, Russian would have been one of the most predominant languages spoken, certainly in the eastern part of the country. In the western part of the country, you would not have used Ukrainian as an open public language, or certainly not in official documents. It was, you know, all of the languages of the Soviet Union were suppressed during the Soviet period. So in a way, it's a linguistic distinction that is owing to, you know, the complications of, or the oversimplicities perhaps, of the Soviet Union. It is a really difficult point of, you know, what is Ukrainian, what is Russian in some ways, because one of Zelensky's great strengths is his ability to be able to speak to both populations. You know, he is a Russian-speaking Ukrainian. He's from a place I spent time in the mid-90s, which is then it was called Krivoy Rog in Russian. It means crooked horn, a town in central Ukraine, and it's now called Krivy Rih. So you hear Krivoy Rog, Krivy Rih. And when he would have been growing up there, he would have been a Russian speaker, and he still was, really, up until several years ago. And most of his film and comedy career is in the Russian language, including the character that he plays in Servant of the People, where he plays the teacher who accidentally becomes president, and then, of course, life imitated art. But then we see in 2018, they found the party that's called the Servant of the People, and then he's elected in April 2019. He changes from being, just as Krivoy Rog becomes Krivy Rih, he goes from being Vladimir Zelensky to being Volodymyr Zelensky. And his strength now is that he's able to speak equally in both languages. So it's been fascinating to see the broadcast that he's made in the last 2 weeks in Russian, you know, including making direct appeals using the two form in Russian, ты instead of вы, which is really interesting, making these very direct appeals to Putin where he says to him, come on now, using the to form, come and sit down with me, I'm your neighbour. What are you afraid of? Let's sit down and talk in this very informal way and in Russian. And then speaking in, you know, he's such a beautiful voice as well. You know, you can really tell he's a performer, speaking, you know, beautiful Ukrainian. In his early career, he was criticized for not speaking good enough Ukrainian. So that gives you some measure of this journey. But it is a very sensitive issue. It's in some ways at the heart of this issue. And there, I've been trying to watch as much Russian language content as I can over the last week, trying to understand what Russians are saying about this, those who buy into the official narrative and those who don't. And even for those who do buy into the narrative, they are questioning, you know, these people are our brothers, you know, they're our... You see, this is exactly where the problem comes from, though, because they'll say, you know, they're ours. You know, we are one. And you can see that in a good way. And sometimes Zelensky appeals to that sense of, come on, you know, this, we're from the same part of, you know, this, our psyche is the same. But at the same time, that's a dangerous thing to say, because the whole point is they are no longer one. And you need to choose which side you're on.
That's Viv Groskop talking to me earlier. And you can hear the full version of that interview on the latest edition of Meet the Writers. It's available to download from our website or wherever you get your podcasts. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Well, it's time now to discuss the impact of the conflict on the world of art with Ben Luke, who's review editor at the Art newspaper and host of its podcast. Ben, thanks so much for coming in.
Not at all.
How are Ukrainians attempting to protect their art and their monuments at this time?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, one of the things that we know from the history of conflict is that museums have strategies to put their works up, to pack their works up and put them away. But that's been happening. Museums across the country have been... there's this sort of horrible process that you see, curators have been interviewed about it, where they're packing away the works, they're putting libraries into cases and putting them away for however long, you know, and then taking them underground, you know, obviously to sites that we won't know because they've got to be secret. But of course, that's protecting them to a degree, but it's not utterly failsafe. It's a heartbreaking process, actually. Yeah. I think for the curators, and there's extraordinarily brave people who are staying in these museums, sleeping in these museums to protect the works, and you hear this time and again in conflict. It was, you know, when you think about Iraq and Afghanistan and the appalling things that happen to heritage over there. And you know, you can just see this cycle repeating over again.
Now, Russia's demanded the return of artworks from abroad. What's the detail on that?
Well, there are a number of works in Italy that have been requested, but for instance, a couple of works from the Hermitage Museum. And this is a two-way thing. So, for instance, there's a Titian that's from the Hermitage Museum, which will be some way making its way back to Moscow, to St. Petersburg. We don't know how. But for instance, we know now also that the Raphael exhibition at the National Gallery in London will not now have a really wonderful Raphael painting from the Hermitage because it's not going to be lent from Russia. So there's this sort of two-way thing which is happening. Also, we're finding that contemporary artists or modern artists' work is being removed from exhibitions. A Christian Boltanski exhibition in St. Petersburg has been cancelled at the request of his heirs because they just felt that it was not in keeping with the philosophy, the thinking, and the work itself, which was tremendously humanitarian. How could that then be shown in St. Petersburg while the invasion is happening? Ragnar Kjartansson withdrew his works from a new museum in Moscow, which is the GES2 museum. So he's removed and accused, you know, gone full out and said, you know, I'm doing this as a protest against Russian fascism. So we're seeing that artists from outside of Russia are removing works, and then simultaneously Russian museums are recalling their works. But it's very difficult, of course, with no flights going into Moscow. I mean, yes. How these works are going to make their way back to Moscow is another question.
And how have sanctions on Russia and the withdrawal of Russian money affected the art market?
This is a really interesting question. It's clear that lots of Russian collectors are still very active in the market. People in the market say that the amount of Russian money money in the market is much less than it was, say, a decade ago. I don't know if you remember, about a decade ago, Roma and Abramovich bought a bacon very, you know, with much show in at auction for a lot of money, for many millions. There was rumours too that Abramovich was behind the acquisition of a Picasso, which was lent to the Tate in London. I don't know if that was ever substantiated. So there was a lot of Russian money. I think there still is a lot of Russian money on the market. But for instance, there were auction houses saying that most of the collectors in the recent auctions were in North America and Asia. There's a massive market for new collectors in Asia. But of course, there are links between the market and Russia. You know, the Phillips auction house is owned by a Russian luxury goods company. Phillips has come out and said, you know, unequivocally that the invasion is an abomination, and they even donated to the Ukrainian Red Cross some of the earnings from that auction. So there is, but still, you know, as ever, the art market is opaque. If Russian collectors are still buying, we don't know. Even sanctioned individuals could potentially find ways to buy works through back doors and loopholes, because the market is desperately opaque.
Yeah. Now, how is this going to affect the Venice Biennale?
The Venice Biennale is really interesting. There's this extraordinary story about the Ukrainian pavilion. It will be in the Arsenale. And at first, the mutterings from the, you can imagine, from the Ukrainian artists and curators were, we're going to try and get there, but we don't know how. But it turns out that this installation, which was made up of several component parts, was smuggled effectively out of Ukraine into Poland on the back seat of the curator's car. Extraordinarily, the artist is in Kiev at the moment. He says he hopes to be there. This is Pavlo Makov, the artist. One of the curators, as I say, is in Poland. Another of the curators is pregnant and in Kiev. So you can't imagine the distress that they're experiencing. So the Ukrainian pavilion will go ahead. Then there's the Russian pavilion. The artist withdrew from the Russian pavilion and made a very overt statement, and I fear for them in terms of the current climate, in terms of the crackdown on anybody expressing any opposition to war in Russia. So it seems likely that the Russian pavilion is going to be empty. But again, this extraordinary connection between geopolitics and culture. The Russian pavilion, the curators of the Russian pavilion, it was a company called Smart Art, and one of the people who run Smart Art is Ekaterina Vinokurova, who is actually the daughter of Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister and one of the architects of the invasion. So you get that sense of the bound up nature of culture and geopolitics in that pavilion.
I mean, when we look back at the Second World War, I mean, again, as you were saying, so many wonderful paintings hidden by very, very brave people. But also those who did business with Hitler were not regarded kindly by history. And I wonder if the art markets learnt that lesson.
I think that there does seem to be a very strong commitment right at the start of this to distance the from the market, to distance itself from them. There's lots of due diligence being done, it seems. I mean, lots of people are saying it's long overdue, of course, that there's long been suspicion about this. Why didn't this happen in 2014 when Putin invaded the Crimea? Why didn't this happen much earlier? But there does seem to be a very concerted effort, that the auction houses are at pains to stress how much they are following regulations, how much they are exploring who the collectors are, what their histories are, and they are following absolutely strictly the regulations. But I think it's very clear that people are trying it now, and lots of people are saying it's too late, to distance themselves from all this Russian money that's swilling around in the art market.
Ben Luke, thank you very much indeed. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Emma Searle, Paige Reynolds and Charlie Filmer-Court, our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett, and our studio manager, Christy Evans, with editing assistance from Nora Hall. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London, where we'll bring you breaking news and analysis. The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow with Emma Nelson in the chair. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.